All right, Luke 17, starting with verse 34. Who would like to read for us?
And I tell you, in that night there will be two men and one dead, and one will be taken and the other will be left. Two women will be grinding together, and one will be taken and the other left. The two men will be in the field, and one will be taken and the other left. And they answered and said unto him, Where, Lord? And so he said to them, Wherever the body is, there the eagles will be gathered together.
All right. Thank you. Fascinating little section here. And does anybody here have an NIV that you were reading out of? Did you notice something as she was reading along? Yes. All right, and the two men in the field is not in the NIV. I'll explain a tiny bit about that as we go along. But I just wanted to acknowledge that because I knew some of you would have been going, hey, what's going on here? It's probably not alone the NIV, but that's probably the only translation that would be here that has it that way. I'm going to just ask you some fact questions this time, and we're going to focus a little bit more on interpretation stuff. So, who speaks in these verses? Jesus, and to whom? He's talking to his disciples about what occasion? Just the facts, ma'am. What does it say in the verse? What occasion is he talking about? That night. Yes. And then there are some scenarios that happen on that night. How many scenarios, how many different sort of pictures or scenes or situations does he describe happening on that night? Three, or if you've got the NIV, two. All right. So let me explain a tiny bit why there's that difference there. This is actually a difference in manuscripts. When the King James Version was translated, we had far fewer ancient manuscripts to work from than we have now. In other words, since 1611, when that was done, we've found a whole mess more of ancient manuscripts of the Greek New Testament. And so we've got really a lot more to work with to try to reconstruct the original text. And among all those Greek manuscripts, there are minor differences, little variances, words left out or inserted in different places, nothing that changes the meaning substantively, but the kinds of errors that copyists would make copying something by hand. And here's the logic behind why this is left out in the NIV, which is a newer translation, and it's based on all this extra evidence that we have now that they didn't have when the King James was done, for instance. The reasoning is that it's likelier for somebody to add something extra while they're copying than to leave something out. They were very, very careful about omitting anything. But it makes more sense for a scribe, you know, copying down to come to this, you know, there's two women grinding and two in the bed, and something is missing here. I just know there's a... And to add that in, because actually that phrase is found in Matthew 24, I think it's 16 or 19, no, 24:39. It has the women grinding and two men in the field in Matthew's account. And so the scribe, who just got through copying Matthew, is now copying Luke, and he goes, boy, I bet the guy who made this copy before me forgot that phrase. And so he puts it in, even though it may not have been there originally in Luke. And the evidence, if you're able to look at a whole set of manuscripts of Luke over time, the evidence seems to support that reasoning, because the older ones tend to have fewer of those kind of extra things, and the more recent ones tend to have more of them. Does that make sense to you? They've seen this in the manuscripts over time, that it's more common for something to get added accidentally by a scribe, maybe from some other place in a parallel account in one of the Gospels, than it is for something to be left out. The other thing I would suggest is that how much sense does it make for two men to be in the field at night? Did you notice this is a night occasion? What would you be doing in the field at night? Yeah, watching your sheep, perhaps. And it is possible that two men would be in the field at night. But most of the time at night, You know, you can't see anything out there. You come in. Pardon? Women can be grinding grain indoors where there's light. Yes, and people sleep in bed. You know, those are more consistent with a nighttime thing. In Matthew's account, Matthew 20:24-39, there's no mention of night, right? It has women grinding grain and men in the field, but there's not a nighttime setting. So that's not solid evidence, but in support of the manuscript evidence, it also makes a little bit more sense when you realize Jesus is talking about a night occasion here, that two men in the field was probably added by somebody who thought, boy, they must have left this out accidentally. Anyway, the reality is it doesn't make a big difference in the meaning of the text, one way or the other. But for our purposes this morning, I'm just going to focus on the two that I'm sure are there, you know, original to Luke, right? So we're going to talk about the two in the bed and the women grinding grain. We could probably draw the same conclusions from what it's talking about with the men in the field. But I don't think that Luke originally had those in there. I think that was accidentally included. Not that Jesus never said it, because obviously he did in Matthew's account. You know, we have it there. But every writer is making a point, and they include the things that fit with what they're trying to say. For the most part, we want to hear what they're saying. All right. So, of the two scenarios that we're sure are there, at least, what do they have in common? Two people, right? One taken, one left. There's a separation of those two people into two groups. Anything else they have in common? Yes, they're doing something together. In the case of sleeping in the same bed, that's a, how would you characterize that togetherness? How many people have you been in the same bed with?
Well, I've been in the bed with my brother.
Very few people that you've been in the same bed with. I don't think I've ever even been in the same bed with my brother, although, you know, in a lot of families, kids sleep in the same bed together at certain stages in their lives. In the old days, kids probably shared beds a lot more when beds were scarcer.
When the money was tight.
Corinne and I visited various sites where the Little House in the Prairie stories took place. And one of the places was a hotel in Independence, Missouri, I think it was. Where Ma and Pa Ingalls worked for a while when they had bad luck on the farm further north. And when we learned that for 25 cents a night, you could have one of three spots on a bed about this wide at that hotel. You would be sharing the bed with perfect strangers
in that amount of space.
If you had 75 cents and you could afford 75 cents, you could pay for the whole bed. You could have it to yourself. But the average person, apparently, was desperate enough for a dry place to sleep that they would pay 25 cents to share a bed fully clothed with two perfect strangers. But this is uncommon, all right? We don't normally do this. I was blown away. People would actually do that. The stagecoach driver got his own bed, because he brought all the business to the hotel. But it was only this wide. So it's not like they were giving him a real bargain. But at least he got to sleep on his own. They didn't bother putting doors on the hotel rooms. You know, because you didn't go into your hotel room for privacy, obviously, in that kind of a situation. And you know, we say hotel. I mean, this was basically just a, well, not even a good-sized house. I mean, it was just a house with a few rooms. And but, you know, if you were on the road, it was a dry place to sleep. You're happy to plunk down your 25 cents and catch some shut-eye. But that's unusual, right? Typically, if you're sharing a bed with somebody, you could conclude that your relationship with them is reasonably close and intimate. So, each story has two people doing something together, perhaps something indicating a closeness in the relationship. And they're separated then into two categories, taken and left. What's different between the two scenarios? And they're practically the same story, repeated. What's different?
One's resting and the other one's working.
Right. In one case, they're resting or sleeping, and the others are working. Well, actually, this wasn't the part with the roof. This is the part with them sleeping in a bed or grinding grain. So, but the activities are different, if you can call sleeping an activity, right? And the locations are a little bit different, it would seem. Pardon? The people involved? Yes, all right. And it actually doesn't say men in the first case, two men in one bed. It says two, but the word two is masculine. And so that's why some translations render it two men. But in Spanish, if it said two and it was masculine, would that mean it was two men? No, and neither does it in Greek. Right? They use the masculine if one of them is male. So it could be a couple. Right? It could be a married couple that it's talking about here, or it could be two men. Based on the grammar. We don't know just based on the grammar. Obviously, it seems likelier to me that two people are sharing a bed, it's a couple. But that's sort of my culture looking at it. It doesn't prove that that's the case. And the other one, it also doesn't have the word women. Two, grinding grain. But the word two, duo, in this case is feminine. So we know it is two women grinding grain together. Right, so the genders are different, and the activities are different. Upon hearing this, what do the disciples want to know?
Where?
Where, Lord? And what does Jesus answer?
Wherever the body is,
there the vultures or eagles, it was probably a more generic word for kind of birds of prey, will be gathered. All right, so anybody else here curious, like the disciples, to know where? I'd like to know where. If you knew that there was a place where you got a 50-50 chance of being taken or left, what would you do? Well, but if you knew that everybody who goes in there, of all the people who go in there, you got a 50-50 chance of getting out, I think I would not try to figure out how to get taken. I think I'd try to figure out how not to go to that place in the first place. Right? You know, they say if you break your arm in two places, what should you do? Stay out of those two places. Now, I don't know if that's why the disciples are asking where. But they want to know where. How directly does Jesus answer the disciples? It's not a terribly direct answer. He doesn't give them longitude and latitude. He gives them this sort of weird saying. And by the way, I believe that this saying, Jesus didn't invent for the occasion. In fact, I've heard other people use this saying, this proverb, in different contexts myself, although they got it from Jesus. I've heard Craig Klatt use this proverb, he's the former pastor here, to describe the behavior of people. So what if we ignore the context here? What is this proverb getting at? Do you understand what I'm saying? Jesus is quoting a proverb that people had heard. It isn't unique to this situation here. It has a meaning of its own that kind of stands on its own. What is this proverb getting at? Where there's a dead body, there the vultures will gather.
Cleansing process.
Sounds almost like the time at the end.
It is.
Yes, but I'm suggesting that this is a proverb which has its own meaning, apart from how Jesus is using it here. And he is adapting it to this situation. But what does it mean in general to say, where there's a dead body, there the vultures will gather? What other context might you use a saying like that?
There's no body there to be taken.
I suppose it implies something about that.
A given.
It's a given, all right? This is an obvious sort of a thing, all right? We have the expression in English, an ambulance chaser. Have you ever heard that expression?
Yeah.
What is an ambulance chaser? Yes, but what is really at the root of when we call, if you call someone an ambulance chaser? Yes, it's a lawyer who is chasing down someone who has had a loss in order to try to get involved in litigation and again profit from their loss. Sometimes we refer to those people as vultures. Right? There's sort of a truism that you can tell when somebody has had an accident by the crowd of ambulance chasers that gather around them. Right? We make those kind of expressions, even reduced down to ambulance chaser. The implication is, when you see an accident, you know you'll see the ambulance chasers. Or if you see the ambulance chasers, you'll know there's been an accident. And that's what Jesus is saying. It's a given, right? Wherever this happens, it'll be obvious. There's visible evidence of what's going on. So, what is Jesus saying to the disciples, then, in answer to their question, where? They want to know where, and he gives this cryptic, wherever there's a dead body, the vultures will be gathered.
Well, it's going to be obvious.
Yeah. You don't need to know where. Because when the time comes, you could follow the trail of vultures. Isn't that interesting? When the time comes, it will be obvious. And the other implication is, it wouldn't do me any good to tell you where. Right? Yeah, because that's not the point. You probably can't avoid the events that he's talking about by being in the right or wrong place. Wherever you are, it's going to come to you. And you don't need to know where in advance, because it'll be obvious when it happens. How consistent is that with Jesus' reply to the Pharisees back a few verses when they said, "Tell us when the kingdom will come"? Yeah, but he also said, but you can't observe it. You know, you don't need to know when, and you aren't going to understand where. It'll be obvious when it happens. So what does that tell us about the disciples, that even after hearing all that Jesus has said, they're asking where? How well are they understanding what Jesus is getting at? Monty, you're shaking your head. They don't get it at all, you know. They're still thinking in terms of geography when Jesus is speaking in terms of spirituality. He's talking to them about realities that you can't put on a map or time with your watch. right. What else are you curious about from these verses? What do you want to know? Here's the scenario. Two people, very closely connected, divided into two groups. Pardon? Why? All right. What event is this? What is going on here that causes this separation between the two groups? All right? Good. What else?
I think of things as being happening in a group setting or a corporate setting, but I wonder how many of these things could we apply to a one-person setting?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll, I think, spend a little more time on that as we go along here. Why do I care if people are divided into two groups? Unless I know, not just when.
What's the difference
between the two groups? Oh, who cares? One's taken, the other's left. So what? So I want to know, well, what does that mean, to be taken or left? You know, if this is apparently significant enough division between two people that Jesus is telling his disciples about it, so I want to know, why are they being divided? What makes the difference, which group you end up in? And what does it mean to be divided? What are the different groups? Anything else that you're curious about? Well, obviously the where that the disciples are curious about. Yeah, although the Pharisees already asked when. Of course, Jesus answered them with, you don't need to know where either. The disciples have been paying attention. But if the disciples thought of this in terms of geography, that they could avoid being in the wrong place at the wrong time, where is a perfectly valuable question. And if you think of it in this sense, taken where? Or left where? It makes perfect sense for them to ask where. Who cares if you're taken or left? Unless you know where taken to or where left at. All right, so it's a good question that they've asked. So we want to know, what does taken or left mean? And part of that would be taken where, left where. And we want to know, what is going on here that causes this taken left business to happen at all? Well, let's take a little bit of time on those. There's one other detail that I wanted to make a comparison about. The separation that happens, right? One taken, the other left. On what basis does that separation take place? This is really asking the why question. Why is one taken and the other left? You're right, it doesn't say in the verse. And so this is where, if we really want to know why, how do you find out? Go back in the context. So should we leave the question just that broad? What is the basis of the separation between the two? Why are some taken and others left? And I'm going to point out one little grammatical detail as you're thinking about that. Did you notice who made the decision which group someone was going to be in? If we just go back a couple verses, like on that day, no one is on the roof of his house with the goods inside, should go inside to get them. Right? You get to decide whether you're going to be in the group that went back after stuff and was sorry, or in the group that fled for your life and was glad. But I already answered my own question. Who makes the decision? Right? You, by your own actions, are choosing which group you're going to be in that scenario. Who makes the decision in the verses we're looking at today? Yeah, it's called the passive voice. One will be taken. The question is, by whom? Right? It's left unanswered in the passive voice. But it means the people who are involved are passive. It happens to them. One will be taken and the other left. They are not doing it themselves. They are not, in that moment anyway, making the decision about whether they will go or stay. So the question still is, why are some taken and others left? What makes the difference in that moment, which group one ends up in? Go ahead and take a moment to look back in the context and see if you can give us a biblical response.
To verse 30.
Go back to verse 30. Go ahead.
It says, it will be just like this on the day that the Son of Man is revealed.
All right. What insight is that giving you?
When the Son of Man is revealed, that's the end of all things. When He comes. That's what I see here.
All right. So it seems that no matter where you are on the planet, no matter what you're doing, no matter who you're with, something is going to happen to you at the second coming.
Yes.
And you will be divided one way.
One will go to heaven and the other one will go to the sudden destruction.
It's very interesting because, this is obviously what this whole section is dealing with here. Although we noted the last couple verses that those, when people are still making decisions, obviously that's not the very day of His coming. But when people are no longer making their own choices, actively in the moment, it begins to sound like we have approached the actual day, hour, or in this case, night, when a force from outside will separate people. They won't be sitting there going, oh, no, go this way, I don't go that way. It will come upon them. All right, that would be consistent with that. Anyone have more to add? Joy, you look like you were about to speak.
Well, verse 21 says, for indeed the kingdom of God is within you.
Interesting.
So they have to have had this decision made.
Yes. Right, so what actually happens on the day that the Lord appears and people are divided into one of two groups, it is not based arbitrarily on God's decision when He arrives.
They've already made it.
They've been making and have made before that time a decision which determines which camp they will be in by whether the kingdom is within them or not. And Joy, you've hit perfectly on the topic sentence of this whole section to point that out to us. That was what the Pharisees' question sparked. You can't avoid the judgment by knowing when and where it's going to be, nor can you make it happen by knowing when or where it's going to be. All you can do is prepare yourself personally, internally, for that event, because it's going to come on everyone in the whole world, whether you like it or not. Very true. So what do taken and left mean, then, in this context? What parallels do we have here of people being divided into one or the other group? All right, we have the story of Sodom and Lot. Yeah, the story of Sodom and the flood, right? During which, in both cases, some outside force or event came upon a group of people who had made a decision ahead of time that affected how they fared, all right? But when that event came upon them, they were divided into two groups. What are the two groups? Give me bottom line, two groups.
Satan and
saved and lost, alive and dead, made it, didn't make it. So taken and left, we don't even have to know which is which, do we? I mean, taken could be taken to heaven and left could be left on earth. Or taken could be taken away by the floodwaters and left could be remaining alive in the ark. It doesn't really matter which is which. But there's only two groups. And one of them is alive, saved, and the other is dead and lost. Now, I mean no offense to anybody who may have background with the secret rapture or have some stock in believing in that, but how much support does this text lend to the concept of a secret rapture when you understand it in context? Do you understand the question? The name Left Behind for the film Left Behind is taken from these verses. And the concept being that some will be taken and the others left. But the way the story goes in the film and the teaching of the rapture, those that are left alive. And they're still here on earth and they still, you know, have an opportunity to try to figure out a relationship with God. And where is that in the text?
It's not there.
Now, there's two groups and one's alive and one is dead. Now, this doesn't deal with everything about the rapture, all right? But I'm just saying this one text is not supportive of the doctrine of the rapture if you look at it in its context. And if you talk with people who are actually serious scholars who believe in the rapture theory, they don't try to use this text to say that because they know what it's saying here. It's just sort of been taken in popular use to be used by films like Left Behind and so on. It's sort of quoted in a popular way, but people who try to support from the Bible the rapture theory do not use this text, interestingly enough, if they've had much exposure to the scholarly side of it. So let's go back to the relationship between these two people. And we talked last time about this part of it already. Here's the scenario that I think is happening. Right? Is there anything wrong with sleeping or grinding grain? How appropriate was it for these people to be carrying out those activities? It seems appropriate, even though, you know, in the previous section we saw, you know, the people were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage, and they shouldn't have been doing that, right? They were supposed to be getting in the ark. But apparently here it's appropriate activity. How do we know? Yeah, but so does eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage, and that wasn't appropriate for them. How do we know it's appropriate here? Say that again, Joy.
It doesn't say that it wasn't.
No. Monty, what were you saying?
Maybe talking about a different group of people.
Yes, it may well be talking about a different group of people, but how do we know that there was nothing wrong with what they were doing? There's one obvious reason.
One person of what they were doing will be taken.
Absolutely. One way or the other, one of those people is going to be saved. So this is just normal everyday life. It was appropriate. You got to sleep. You got to eat. Whatever's going on. If it was the inappropriate thing, they'd both been lost. And so we talked about in the flow of history, it's quite likely that these are two people who have obeyed Jesus, who have done exactly what he said, who left all their possessions behind and, you know, fled according to Jesus' command. They're two church people. outwardly speaking, and yet one will be taken, if we assume that would mean saved, and the other left. Even though they're laying this close together in the same bed, or cooking together in the same, I don't know, do we call it a kitchen? If they fled and they're living in a cave, you know, they're laying in the same mattress of pine boughs, all right? And grinding grain with the same rock. What does that tell you about how a person's fate will be decided on that night? Yeah. That your relationships with other people cannot save you. You know, it's not like a tractor beam on Star Trek where if you grab onto their heel, you go with them. Wah! And it doesn't matter how close you are emotionally or relationally to somebody else, their faith cannot save you. And likewise, your faith cannot save them. Even if you can keep them physically close to you, right? It's time to flee to the mountains. Quick, leave your stuff, and they come with you. Physical proximity to people who are obeying Jesus cannot save you, cannot save them. So what is the appropriate thing to do? If you can't save your husband or your friend or anybody else, have you ever been on the airplane? They give you a little safety thing. In the event that cabin pressure is lost, an oxygen mask will fall from the ceiling. Please secure your own mask first before assisting children or other passengers. Because you're the only person. Is this what you were talking about on an individual level? Now, I'm not saying, so go out and be the Lone Ranger. You don't need church. No, I'm not saying that. But you can be in all the right places at all the right times and neglect your own relationship with God, even in trying to save someone else. You can get the oxygen mask on them, maybe, and lose your own. Not likely. Not likely. So first put on your own oxygen mask and then assist those who may need help. Okay? Unless you get too tired. It's absolutely. If I do not take care of myself, I am no use to anyone else.
A person to be lost in a large way.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many serious caregivers do you know that just absolutely? I'm always reminding the caregivers I know in my life to take care of yourself. Just as important as the other person.
And it is a false hope to think that I'm going to save someone else by being loving to them.
Just the first responder or emergency responder, you know, they try to impress upon you the importance of survey the what's going on. You see somebody
get the big picture.
In a swimming pool, you don't just jump in after them.
Yeah, yeah.
If there's a electric line in the pool, you're going to be dead. Attention what's going on around you before you die.
Because if you don't take care of yourself, you're going to be no use to anybody else. Absolutely. And had a challenging conversation with someone recently in which they told me, you're not loving. Because I was challenging them on an issue where they were putting themselves in serious danger. And I finally had to just say, look, offering you accountability when you are putting yourself in danger is loving. It is loving. And it is such a shallow concept of love to tell me that if I'm nice to you and pleasant, you know, and our relationship is fun, that that's love. Do not sacrifice your own integrity, your own relationship with God, your own spirituality, in the hopes that you can relate to someone else in a way that's going to save them. Not going to happen. Well, where's the good news in this story? For at least half of the people. What? Absolutely. You know what story this is? What event this is? No more crying. No more death. No more sorrow. I mean, this is the transition from nighttime to daytime that will never end. No more death. No more fears. No more persecution. No more hunger. No more having to grind grain in the dark by candlelight in a cave or whatever they're doing. And you don't have to have the geography and the timing all figured out.
Don't worry about all that.
It's as simple as investing today in my relationship, which is not complicated. When the event comes, it's going to come upon you. And boom! The good things that you're looking for are going to happen at His initiative and not your own. And that is good news. That is the best news that, historically speaking, that this planet has ever seen. Jesus is coming again.